You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although only 5% of the world's population lives in the United States, we hold 25% of its inmates, and we spend over $80 billion on incarceration each year. In the lead-up to the new administration in Washington, we thought it might be a good time to look at the state of mass incarceration, what's changed and what hasn't changed, along with local issues of policy reform and the juvenile justice system. Joining us now are Dr. Boz Dreisinger, a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, the founding academic director of Prison to College Pipeline, and author of Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. Mariam Kaba, the founder of Project Naya, an organization that is working to end youth incarceration. She's also a member of Survived and Punished, a coalition focused on ending the criminalization of survivors of violence. And Derek Hamilton, a self-taught jailhouse lawyer who was in prison for 21 years after a wrongful murder conviction. He was exonerated in January 2015 and now works as a paralegal helping others who claim that they've been wrongfully convicted. Pleased to welcome all of you to our show. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
According to data reported by the ACLU, from 1978 to 2014, our prison population rose 408%. We have the largest number of incarcerated in the world. What are the biggest drivers of mass incarceration in the U.S.? Is it just simply drug laws?
From my perspective, I think it's racism. In my community where I grew up at, cops would pull you over, rash you. You had no Fourth Amendment rights. And sometimes they would put drugs in your pocket to make an arrest. So from my perspective, it's racism. It is a lack of looking at people as human beings.
According to the NAACP, African Americans now constitute nearly 1 million of the total 2.3 million in our jails and prisons. So we'll go a little later. We'll get into the impact of that on the African-American communities. But this rise has occurred during both Republican and Democratic administrations. So this is not a political thing.
Well, when you have a war on drugs, right, and when you put your resources in a certain community and make that war against just one community, then you're going to have the disparity. I think whenever you have, I give you an example, Edward Byrne, a police officer, was wrongfully murdered in Queens in the 80s by a drug cartel, so they say. President Bush was the president at that time, retired his badge, and he had a war on our communities. That means innocent people that had nothing to do with the crack cocaine trade was being swept up because they was hanging out on corners, and they was being charged with crimes they never committed. So whenever you have policies that direct certain communities, you have injustice.
Yeah, I think we have to keep in mind that it's certainly about the war on drugs, but it's also about truth and sentencing laws that are ensuring that people have longer sentences, that they serve out these full sentences. It's about bad prosecution. There are so many forces that come into play, but I'm glad we started off right off the bat with racism because it's about the policies being systemically racist.
Mandatory minimums.
Yes, mandatory minimums, again, truth in sentencing laws that are pushing people to stay in prison for the full term.
We often talk, Boz, about mass incarceration in terms of statistics. Is there a downside to doing that?
Absolutely. I think when we talk statistics, we forget about the humanity behind bars, and we forget about that these are people, living, breathing people. And unfortunately, due to the nature of the way that prison is presented in so much mass media, it's so easy to dehumanize people in prison and not associate them with a face.
And in fact, it also, we forget when we're talking about this, that this has a real impact on the families and communities that the people who are sent to prison come from.
The ripple effect, I mean, you're destroying the fabric of communities, you're destroying families, the children of those incarcerated. This is broad.
To back up what you said, Derek, Michelle Alexander, civil rights attorney, argues that mass incarceration is metaphorically the new Jim Crow.
Absolutely. I mean, I've served time in prison, and I was saying to Boz earlier, you know, you have to work in prison. I mean, if you don't work, you're locked up, you're put in special housing unit 23 hours a day. you're paid less, way less than the minimum wage. You might get 40 cents a day, and you're required to do mass labor. I mean, every license plate that you see on a car in the United States is made by a prisoner. These same people get out of prison and don't have jobs when they've worked 20 years on making license plates. We don't have companies in the United States that make them because prisoners do them. They don't get a pension when they get out. They don't get an apartment. They don't even get anything. They're just thrown out of prison with this skill with nowhere to go. So I think that we have to change the way we look at people, not just prisoners. If you go to a housing project in Brooklyn, those people are treated like they're prisoners. You know, and we need to change. Like she said, it's a humanity issue. We need to treat people like human beings.
And we also should remember that we just are coming out of the largest prison strike in history, the labor strike, and which got remarkably little coverage in much of the mainstream media. It took a lot of push for it to even get coverage. Yes. And we are now in this moment of people rising up and protesting this. Right.
Mariam, you wanted to add to that.
I do. I think I want to put in a word for the danger, frankly, of understanding hyper and mass incarceration as being driven mainly by the drug war, which is actually not the main driver of mass incarceration. We have to address the fact that if we let every single person out of prison right now that is in there because of a drug crime, we would still have mass incarceration. So we're going to have to do an honest accounting for the fact that many people are also locked up for use of violence, as violence is constructed in the ways in which it's defined, which obviously it's defined across a spectrum. We're also going to have to release people who are currently on the inside having been accused of violent crimes. And I think without that being actually part of the agenda, we're not going to actually end mass incarceration.
Isn't the modern prison system a relatively recent invention, Hal? Did the tough-on-crime politics of the 80s and 90s fuel this explosion in incarceration rates?
Well, if you really look at the history of the rise of mass incarceration, it comes into being during the 1970s, in part as a backlash to the 1960s demands for justice and equality. So when you look at, and you mentioned before, that mass incarceration is a bipartisan project, I think that's very important to pay attention to. Liberals contributed to the rise of the prison nation as well. And they did that through being focused on procedural kinds of reforms that were seen as ways to actually get other things passed and ended up contributing to the criminalization of more people. We're not going to get out of this without an understanding that sometimes when people are passing laws, they have unintended consequences to actually criminalize more people and funnel more people into the system. So I'm really paying attention to the fact that, you know, Bill Clinton and others who were in office helped to contribute to this. We look to Nixon and Reagan, and we leave out Johnson and Clinton and even Barack Obama from the story. We really have to put them all into the story together.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that Obama's pardons have all been, and commutations have all been drug-related, which is a very distressing reality. I think, too, what needs to get us out of this is a radical rethinking of the system itself and what I think of as radical imagination. Because, as you mentioned, yes, prisons as a response, certainly mass incarceration is a recent phenomenon. Incarceration, period, is a relatively recent phenomenon. It's about 200 years old in its use as an exclusive response to crime. And that is not a long time. There are other ways of dealing with crime and creating public safety.
You've investigated prisons around the world, Boz. How do American criminal, how does our system compare with other places?
Well, the distressing reality, of course, we know that we are the largest incarcerator, so we have the largest prison population. We also have some of the longest sentences in the world.
Now, you would think it would be China or some other country, an authoritarian country.
Well, you'd think, but that is not the case. And I think the reality, too, is that we have foisted this system upon the world. I think one of the most distressing things that I saw in traveling the world and looking at prison systems was the way that other countries are imitating limiting our approach to justice or injustice, rather. And that is in using prisons as an exclusive response to crime, in the death penalty, although many countries have stepped back on that, and especially in the war on drugs, which is in direct imitation of ours.
I'm speaking with Dr. Boz Dreisinger, Mariam Kaba, and Derek Hamilton. Mariam, how do we address the needs of children whose parents are incarcerated? In what ways are their lives affected by it?
They're greatly affected by having parents on the inside. Currently, we have 2.7 to 3 million children with an incarcerated parent. If you add jails to that, the number expands even further. Those young people that have parents on the inside often end up having to live with other family members, so they're dislocated that way. They are often economically impacted. The person who was taking care of them was also the primary breadwinner, so now they're in economic insecurity. The emotional trauma of incarceration and separation from your parent is great. And that has impact on kids' ability to study and focus in school. So it ends up being sometimes a domino effect of badness from the incarceration of your parent to the emotional and economic and other social impacts on your own life, which sometimes pushes you back into the system yourself, whether it's in the foster care system, which is a predictor for who ends up locked up behind bars. There was a study a few years ago that showed that fully 85% of the people, the men who were incarcerated in California, had been in the foster care system at some point in their lives. So there's a real foster care to prison pipeline that we have to pay attention to, understand, and make sure that we're dismantling. It has a huge impact. We also can't forget, when we're talking about mass incarceration, that we also lock up children, both in detention and in prison. And that is something that is unconscionable, when all the empirical research suggests that prisons and jails actually make young people worse. So we really have to think about dismantling both the pipelines to prisons and jails, but also ending and closing prisons and jails as well.
And getting back to that racial disparity, 1 in 9 African-American children in the United States has an incarcerated parent, compared to 1 in 28 Hispanic children and 1 in 57 white children.
And I'd like to add that when you talk about poverty, when you talk about a parent who may have been uneducated and went out and sold drugs to feed his family, I mean, here's a guy that probably didn't have any other means in his mind than to sell drugs to feed his family. Now, he went to jail. So the poverty issue that caused him to commit that crime in the beginning is still there. So now you have the mother and the kid who has to be on public assistance, when the guy should have got a diversionary program. He could have got probation. He could have got some other alternative to incarceration and taught a skill which he could have made money for his family, opposed to send him to prison. So I think that the examples that we give the children, you know what I mean, because your father sold drugs, he's a bad guy, he's terrible, it turns a child against his parent. It makes the child start saying, "Dad, you in jail because of something you done," and it turns the parent against the child. I did 21 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit. Every year I was telling my children that I'll be home. At some point they said, "Dad, you a liar. You keep telling me every year you're coming home." And I'm really believing I'm coming home because I didn't do anything. So,
and you had abandoned them in their minds.
In their mind. So the system turns families against each other by painting me out to be a bad guy. That's the image that my children start to look at me at.
I think from a philosophical perspective, too, if I can just say, that speaks to the sort of cycle of harm that's produced by punishment altogether.
Yes.
And it's just one harm leading to another harm to another harm that trickled down to everyone.
We have to take a little break. We'll be back with more from Dr. Boz Dreisinger, Derek Hamilton, and Mariam Kaba, talking about mass incarceration in America. We'll also find out about bail reform and some other aspects, and sending kids to prison, all coming up after this. We are back with a look at mass incarceration in the United States, a country that has the largest prison population in the world, despite only having 5% of the world's population. My guests are Derek Hamilton, Mariam Kappa, and also Dr. Boz Dreisinger. And Derek, when you were 17, weren't you in jail, in the jail for teenage boys on Rikers Island?
Yes.
Had you committed a crime then?
Yes.
So what happened? You'd been a good student. Where did things go wrong?
I was hanging out with some of the older guys in my community who committed a crime. I was arrested. The police officer wanted me to tell them who did it. I refused. They locked me up and charged me for the murder. I did 6 years for that crime. Ultimately, it was reversed by the appellate division. I took something called the Alfred Serrano plea, where I didn't have to admit to the elements of the crime, and I was released.
Is that when you started thinking about studying law?
I've studied law from when I was 17. I began when I was 17 because of the railroad of the system that I was receiving. There was a lawyer by the name of Candace Kurtz who educated me and said, son, you better start studying. What they're doing to you is wrong. And she introduced me to two cases. I read them, I comprehended them, I understood them, and I had a passion for it from that point.
New Yorker writer Jennifer Gonerman has described jailhouse lawyers as an occupation born in desperation because most prisoners cannot afford lawyers and are eligible for a free attorney only for their first appeal.
And that is true, and I think that's something else we should change. You know, innocent people should have more than one appeal.
But there's an assumption that if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you. That's not true?
There's a limit to that. They say that once your direct appeal is heard, there's finality in the judgment, and there is no more right to free counsel.
And a national survey that was published this week by the National Center for Access to Justice found that people in poverty have virtually no access to civil aid attorneys. Only 0.64 are available for 10,000 people, as opposed to an average of 40 lawyers for 10,000 people in the general population. Buzz, have you looked into that?
I mean, the statistics say it all, and I think that directly correlates with another grand disgrace of ours, which is our bail system. The fact that we are keeping people incarcerated without proper representation in desperate conditions where they're likely to take a plea bargain, do anything to get out of the conditions of our jails. And certainly we're at the capital of that right here in New York City, thinking about Rikers Island as an absolute horror show. You're in Rikers. Your life is at risk every single day. You're going to take that plea bargain and do anything to get out of there.
And, Derek, you were at Rikers. Why is it so terrible? Could they have improved it?
Absolutely. You know, you got to look at the prison guards. You got to start with the education that they get and how to deal with individuals who are basically locked up, whether they're guilty or not. They'd be degraded. The moment you walk in prison, somebody is looking in your anus, and excuse it if it's the wrong word to say.
No, it's fine.
And you're degraded.
Not one of the seven words.
You know, and you're degraded. So from the moment you walk in, they think their job is to make you feel less than a human being. And it passes on to prisoners.
And they're doing that because they claim that prisoners hide weapons in their anuses?
But, yeah, that's the security that they use to just do what they want to do. But there's wands. You can use a wand to run over a person's body, and if it rings, he has something. You subject every prisoner that come through there, or detainee, because they're not even prisoners yet, to that particular degrading.
You're saying to dehumanize them?
To dehumanize them and to let you feel inferior. And if you dare to speak up, you're beaten, you're abused, and you treat it more worse.
Well, we keep on hearing about reform at Rikers. Why hasn't it happened?
Because you're not training prison guards. And now, for the first time, they're being punished with the new Bronx DA. But prior to that, look how many times you had guards locked up for beating up prisoners. And look how many claims of prisoners being beat up with the evidence of a photograph to show and medical records to show that the injuries that they're sustaining.
I think, too, reform.
I think we have to be honest about the fact that that these institutions are impervious to reform. You know, the initial Cook County jail, which is in Chicago, is the largest single-use facility. It spans like 20 blocks in a city. And since the establishment of the jail, people have been calling for its reform. These institutions are impervious to reform, which is why people are pushing to close Rikers Island altogether. You cannot reform a system that is set up to be dehumanizing in and of itself. The logics of the system are a problem, and so you need to basically shut that whole entire place down, and people are pushing for that. Obviously, the mayor is, you know, resistant to the closure of Rikers, but it will not be reformed. And we have years and decades of attempted reform to prove that it's unreformable.
Where would we send the people who we now send to Rikers?
Well, there are lots of ideas about that that are being floated, and I want to reiterate that I couldn't agree more. It's not about reform, and I think reform is anathema to those of us in the trenches doing the work. We really feel like things need to be radically restructured. Rikers needs to be shut down. It is atrocious that the bulk of people, more than 80% of people at Rikers have been convicted of nothing and are there languishing away for years. And so I think
some cases because they just can't pay for their bail.
Exactly. And so the question becomes not do we close Rikers, but how do we close Rikers? What do we do? And how do we do it in such a way that we don't then strap a surveillance device on everyone and turn mass incarceration into something happening in everyone's living room? But I think there are lots of innovative organizations working on this right now. Here in New York, Just Leadership USA is doing an excellent job. There's a vigil actually in front of Gracie Mansion in December to push for the close of Rikers. So it's inevitable that it's going to happen. The question is, how do we decentralize and how do we create another term that I think many of us hate, alternatives to incarceration, as if incarceration is the norm and anything else is an alternative.
Right. Go ahead.
Sorry, I wanted to add one last thing, which is that we could achieve enormous amounts of decarceration immediately if we end money bond and if we end pretrial detention. The idea behind bail was that people would be given bail in order to ensure that they would show up for their next court hearing. That was what it was supposed to be for. Bail was not supposed to be a punishment in and of itself. We've turned that into a punishment in and of itself, and we've criminalized poverty as a result of that. If you have money, you can get out of pretrial detention. You can get out of jail. That is unfair, like in the extreme. So I think that all the efforts that are being made, there's a great organization in Chicago called the Chicago Community Bond Fund, which is pushing to abolish bond in Cook County altogether. And they're getting traction. They're getting traction from elected officials. They're getting traction because people understand that this is inhumane. Most jails are worse than the prisons that people end up going into because they are supposed to be places that turn over, because people are only supposed to be there temporarily. I have a cousin currently locked up at Rikers. That place is a hellhole. It needs to be closed.
We're speaking with Mariam Kaba, the founder of Project Naya, and we'll get into more about that in just a moment. Dr. Boz Dreisinger, who's a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, the founding academic director of Prison to College Pipeline and author of Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World, and to Derek Hamilton, who has experienced this thing on a personal level as someone who has been in prison a number of times, including for 21 years for a murder that he did not commit. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Mariam, you have been outspoken online about the case of Bresha Meadows, a 15-year-old girl who's currently being held in an Ohio detention center. What's that story?
Bresha was...
Bresha?
14. Okay. Yeah, her name is Bresha. Bresha was 14 years old in July of this year when she used her father's gun to kill him while he was sleeping. She grew up her entire life being a witness to excruciatingly horrifying violence at the hands of her father against her mother and other people in the community. She basically had run away several times. She'd run away to her aunt, who was a police officer, and her father insisted that she be returned, got the cops to bring her back home, accusing the aunt of kidnapping. The family reached out to social services. At every turn, they were thwarted, and Risha basically had heard her father say that he would kill the entire family over and over again. And fearing that, she decided that she would take matters into her own hands. At 14 years old, she killed him. And now she is in jail in Warren at Trumbull County Detention Center for Youth. And she is awaiting a decision by the prosecutors about whether or not she'll be tried as an adult, which carries with it a huge amount of years in prison, 25 years to life if she's convicted as an adult. And she's waiting for a decision in terms of whether or not she'll be tried at all. Currently, she's been charged with first-degree murder, and she is awaiting some disposition. Today, actually, was the day that she was supposed to have her next hearing. They've postponed it again, and now her next hearing is in January, on January 20th, which means she will have spent over nearly 180 days locked up, waiting for some sort of response to what the situation is, which points to what we were just talking about before, which is that people who are accused of crimes, even crimes that, you know, even if they admit that they've done it, wait inordinate amounts of time for a disposition and an adjudication of their case. So basically, we're making the case that this is a girl, a child. She does not deserve to be tried as an adult. In fact, she should be released into her family's custody so that she can begin the process of being healed from the atrocious violence that she's faced her entire life. While she's been in prison, in jail, right now she's had several suicide watch confinements because of the trauma that she experienced before getting into jail and the trauma of being in jail.
Now, Brisha's situation is not uncommon. Rewire reports that 84% of U.S. girls in juvenile custody have been victims of abuse or experienced domestic violence. In 1990, the last year for which comprehensive data is available, about 90% of the 280 U.S. children who killed their parents were abused. You wanted to add something to that, Derek. I imagine that a lot of the boys who become men who wind up in prison also have been abused as children.
Absolutely. We're talking about a 14-year-old who watched her father commit violence and felt that she had to be a vigilante to protect not only her mother and family but members of the community. I mean, to keep her incarcerated when there's no evidence that she's a threat to the community or that she won't return to court. You know, the Eighth Amendment says no excessive bails or fines. The purpose of that is to make sure that an individual get a bail that they can afford. She's a 14-year-old child. She doesn't have resources to flee. Where she's going at 14-year-old when our great law enforcement couldn't find her? So the question to me is why is she incarcerated? And we should be, as Americans, really, really appalled that this 14-year-old can be abused by our system, because I'm looking at what's happening to her as an abuse of power.
And in fact, I mean, it speaks to the humanity issue of people in prison that we were talking about earlier, because we make an illusory distinction between victim and offender. And we imagine that the people in prison are all offenders, right, when in fact the bulk of them have been victimized, yes, as well. And it's shocking. I mean, I think about the students in the Prison to College Pipeline in my classroom and how many of them, and these are men, not women, how many of them have been subject to abuse in their lives. If people knew that, I think they would think of things very, very differently.
Absolutely.
Every year, thousands of innocent people are sent to jail because they can't afford to post bail. This past August, the Justice Department announced that holding defendants in jail because they can't afford to make bail is unconstitutional. And that's the first time the government has taken such a position before a federal appeals court. But the situation has changed, and I suspect that the political climate really won't allow for much change.
You just said the elephant in the room. I mean, this is what we all haven't been addressing, which is how is all of this momentum that's happening now going to be deeply impacted by a Trump era?
And I think that, you know, if people are involved in local elections, we got judges who don't follow the Constitution, they shouldn't be elected again. I mean, we should go out and say, look, the judge that got this 14-year-old in Chicago, in prison for 180 days should never be elected again because he or she would do it to another child. That's unfathomable.
Didn't you recently play a role in overturning a murder conviction?
Several murder convictions I played a role in overturning. It's my job. I love it.
What have your clients told you about their experiences with trying to access legal representation?
Well, let me just say that there is no such thing. I wouldn't be doing so much pro bono work with pro bono firms if there was access to legal representation. My job since I've come home was to convince lawyers, civil lawyers that have the money to invest in a lot of these innocence cases. I had to beg them and say, look, this is a big problem in our country. I've seen many guys that I know that's innocent. So far, at least 9 guys that I knew that was in prison that was innocent and out. But what I would like to say about the whole criminal justice system, when you talk about reform, we need to talk about training people, judges, prosecutors, police officers, that you're dealing with human beings.
Boz, we don't have much time left, but I wanted to ask you this. Under President Obama, the Department of Justice had its first and second black attorneys general and underwent a massive revamping of the Civil Rights Division, as well as undertaking a series of investigations into abuse and systemic discrimination in 23 police departments. Has that led to any major changes?
Well, it's led to the possibility of changes. Certainly, Obama in his, quote-unquote, fourth quarter has been implementing some positive changes around private prisons, around banning the use of solitary and juvenile for juveniles.
But we hear the private prisons may be back under the new
administration. Exactly. So I think there, and certainly around restoring education for incarcerated students, Pell Grants, all of these things have been done on the federal level. That all of that is very exciting. The great question is what's going to happen next. And I, for one, am quite terrified of Jeff Sessions and Trump's alleged great support for private prisons.
Well, we can't predict, but maybe we'll have this panel back in a year or two and see how things have worked out. And my great thanks to all of you for being on our show, Boz Dreisinger, Mariam Kaba, and Derek Hamilton. We've been talking about mass incarceration in the country that has the largest prison population in the world.